Well, I'm neither Gary, nor will we be studying Philippians chapter 2, but I do hope we can spend some helpful time together. I'd like for us to think about a fairly familiar story to us, the story of the prodigal son, but perhaps from a unique perspective. I've heard a lot of lessons about the prodigal, I guess, from the prodigal's perspective, which is helpful. You might have thought about the brothers, the older brother's perspective, which is also helpful. I'd like to think about it from the father's perspective. I think there's some things we can learn about the father and perhaps some of the main points of the story Jesus tells is really about the father than it is about the prodigal. To really, I think, appreciate the father's perspective and who he is, what he represents in this story, I think we have to understand something of the context that Luke chapter 15 sits within. If we go all the way back to the beginning of Luke chapter 5, we read about in Luke chapter 5 and verse 30, for example, this is when Matthew is called to be an apostle. And you might remember, Matthew was a tax collector, right? Kind of a known scoundrel. Tax collectors today, the IRS, I guess, is not favorably regarded. Hopefully there's no service people here. But in that day, as I understand it, they were really kind of crooks and not very honest, usually seen that way. I don't think Matthew was an exception to that. And yet Jesus calls Matthew to be part of his special following. And in verse 30, it says, the Pharisees and their scribes began grumbling at his disciples, saying, why do you eat and drink with tax gatherers and sinners? The Pharisees can't understand, why is it Jesus would associate with known sinners? Why doesn't he exclude himself, much like the Pharisees and Sadducees did? And then flip a couple more chapters over in Luke chapter 7, and you have this rather striking account here when one of the Pharisees actually invited Jesus into his house, there in verse 36. And he gets there, and there's this woman who is a known sinner. She's understood to be a harlot, and she comes in after Jesus has been in the house for some period of time, and she begins to wipe Jesus' feet with her tears, anoint them with perfume, and to wipe them with the hair of her head. That all sounds kind of unusual, I understand, to us in our day and age, but we know as they wore sandals and had dirt streets, it was more meaningful to wash someone's feet in that day and time. And here is a woman who is a known sinner offering this lowly service to Jesus. And the Pharisee, in his mind, said some things just to himself. He's not saying this out loud, but in verse 39, he says some things in his mind that Jesus then responds to. Verse 39, it says, when the Pharisee who had invited Jesus saw this, he said to himself, if Jesus were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of woman this is who's touching him, that she is a sinner. This Pharisee is appalled, right? He can't believe Jesus would allow a known sinner to wash his feet like this. And so Jesus, I love this when this happens. Jesus responds to what the guy's thinking. That's kind of powerful, right? You're going to listen. If somebody says, oh, I hear what you're thinking here, Terry, that's going to say something about who it is who's speaking. And Jesus says, Simon, I have something to say to you in verse 40. Simon replied, say it, teacher. A certain moneylender had two debtors, one who owed 500 denarii, the other 50. When they were both unable to repay, he graciously forgave them both. Which of them, therefore, Simon, will love him the more? Simon answered, I suppose the one whom he forgave more, verse 43. And he said to him, you have judged correctly. Simon got the right answer, but Jesus isn't sure he got the point just yet. So Jesus goes on to explain to Simon and to us what the point of that story is. Turning toward the woman, verse 44, Jesus said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but she, since the time I came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she anointed my feet with perfume. For this reason, I say to you, her sins, which are many, have been forgiven. For she loved much, but he who is forgiven little loves little. He who is forgiven little loves little. We see someone who was willing to acknowledge their wrong, who is forgiven. And Simon, who, comparatively speaking, probably was a more righteous person. He was the one who was doing lots of things, at least outward things, to follow the law. He was the one who was being hospitable on this occasion. He's not the one whose sins are forgiven. We learn a lot about Jesus, I think, and the Lord in terms of who he cares about, who he loves. He loves those who recognize their wrong. It's been said, and I kind of agree with this, there's two kinds of people. You can obviously break down people in lots of different categories, but there's two kinds of people. There's one kind of people who recognize how lowly they are, and there's the second kind of people who don't yet know but will later come to see how lowly they are. And here we have that contrast. Simon isn't any better than this woman, but he thinks of himself as better. And we see this woman who is lowly in heart serving Jesus. And so we flip a few more pages and get to the immediate context here in Luke chapter 15. And we have verses 1 and 2 where it says, "Now all the tax gatherers and sinners were coming near to Jesus to listen to him. And both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, 'This man receives sinners and even eats with them.'" It's kind of a full-blown now, right? Before it was, you know, chapter 5, it was just Jesus calling Matthew a tax gatherer and socializing with him a bit. And in chapter 7, you've got this example of, you know, this known harlot serving Jesus, washing his feet. Now it's just, it's full-blown. All the tax gatherers and sinners. I mean, Jesus is attracting quite the crowd here. And the Pharisees and scribes, they just kind of bubble over, right? They can't handle this, seeing this teacher with this big following of these sinners. Jesus didn't separate himself with the righteous like the Pharisees did. He spent time with those who were unrighteous. He wasn't afraid to go to those who were sinners. And why is that? Why do you suppose it is that Jesus, this Son of God, was willing to spend time with what are seen as really despicable sinners? Have you thought about that? I think it's because Jesus loves them, right? He cares about them. He knows they need the truth. He loves each one of us, and he loves even sinners. And so we get to chapter 15, and we have really three stories Jesus tells in chapter 15. The first one is of this lost sheep. Now, this is one of 100 lost sheep, right? You got 100 sheep, and one of them goes astray. Now, I don't know much about sheep really at all. I don't know a whole lot about shepherding sheep, but I can tell you that if 99 are doing it well, they're following the herd, you know, this one sheep can't be all that intelligent, right? I mean, this is a sheep that couldn't even follow what the other 99 could. So it wasn't all that important of a sheep, and it's just one of 100. And yet the story is that that shepherd goes to seek that one lost sheep. Jesus loves his sheep, even the one who's stubborn, even the one who's unwilling to follow. And the second account we have is of the woman who lost her coin. Now, she had 10 coins, right? And she lost just one of those coins. Now, we're not told why it was she lost her coin, but I guess you would say it was at least in some part because of her negligence, right? She wasn't careful enough to hold all of her coins together in one place, and she loses one of her coins. I think the Pharisees would have probably said, just let it go. You know, earn another coin somewhere. Don't waste your time looking for this coin. Don't waste your time looking for this sheep that's been lost. You know, go cultivate the son that's still at home, he might say to the prodigal, or the father of the prodigal. You know, you've lost a son. Sure, he's gone his own way, but you've still got one at home. Don't waste your time waiting for and pining for and loving and caring for that son who's gone his own way. And yet Jesus and the Lord isn't that way, is he? Jesus doesn't forget, or the Lord doesn't forget about the one sheep out of 100 that's gone astray. He doesn't stop looking for the one coin of 10. And he doesn't stop longing for the wayward son to come home. And so as we think about the Father's perspective of the story of the prodigal son, I want us to recognize that we are the prodigal. We are the lost coin. We are the lost sheep. Whether we're willing to recognize it, whether we're willing to admit it or not, or whether we're more like the Pharisee, we are the prodigal. Let's begin reading in verse 11. Jesus said, "A certain man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me.' He divided his wealth between them. Not many days later," no surprise there, right? "Not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country, and there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now, when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in the land, and he began to be in need. And he went and attached himself to one of the citizens of that country, and sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he was longing to fill his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving him anything. But when he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired men have more than enough to eat? But I'm dying here with hunger. I will get up, go to my father, and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.' And he got up and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to the slaves, 'Quickly, bring out the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet. And bring the fattened calf, kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this son of mine was dead, and he has come to life again. He was lost and has been found.' And they began to be merry." So we have, as the story begins, this prodigal son, right? Now, the word prodigal is not something I use in my everyday speech. I don't know about you. In fact, I don't know if I've ever heard the word prodigal used outside of Luke 15. But Google would say that it's someone who spends money to excess or recklessly, wastefully. And surely that's what this boy is, right? He demands his inheritance early and goes out and spends it recklessly. What we see here is nothing short of self-destruction on the part of the son. We see physically in verse 14 that he began to be in need. Now, he brought that on himself, right? He didn't use that inheritance wisely. He didn't use it nobly. And therefore, he began to be physically in need. We see that he was socially in need. In verse 16, there was not anyone who was there for him. I suppose while he was spending his inheritance, he might have had a lot of people who were kind of hanging around him, being his friends. But at this point, because of his foolish choices, he was socially ostracized. And then he was emotionally devoid, right? He says of himself, he says, "I'm no longer worthy to be called your son," as he's contemplating returning to his father. He's broken emotionally, and it's not because some circumstance just thrust himself upon him. It's because he made poor choices. He chose to be where he is, and so he's emotionally broken. And finally, we see in verse 13 that he's spiritually broken. It says he squandered his estate with loose living, which we understand to be ungodly living. And so he's physically, socially, emotionally, and most importantly, spiritually broken. And he's not lost because circumstance got the better of him. He's lost because he chose this course of action. And so I'd ask us again, do we resemble this prodigal boy? We may not look physically or outwardly like the boy does in his lowest point here in the middle of this story. We may not be in hunger in the way that he was in hunger, but aren't we much like he is? That because of our choices in life, we find ourselves in deep need? One of the best parts of this story, I think, is that the prodigal recognizes his need to return home. That's kind of the pivotal turning point in this story. Is he finally hits rock bottom. He decides to come home. He's no longer worthy in verse 19 to be called his father's son. And so he makes a commitment that he's going to turn. He's going to come back home. That's a noble thing to do. We applaud people like that, as we should. And he determines that he wants to be as one of his father's hired men. Now, as I understand it, there were three classes of people in a large family or large estate in that time. There were the children, there were the bond servants, and then there were the hired men. And the children, don't have to explain that very well, right? Those were the direct descendants of the person who ran the estate. And they were the ones who were held in the highest regard, right? They were the ones who received the inheritance. Didn't mean that they didn't work. We see even here later in the story that the older brother, who was a child, obviously, was returning from the field. You still worked, you still labored, but you were the chosen, right? You were the one who was going to directly receive the inheritance. And then the second category was the bond servants. And these were folks who worked at the plantation or at the estate, but they had a lengthy commitment to the estate. They had an emotional attachment. We see that several times, in fact, throughout Scripture, that bondservants actually received some portion of inheritance even. They were almost adopted as children. They didn't have the full status of a real child, but they still had a high regard, a high status. They chose to be a part of the house. It wasn't like indentured servitude. They wanted to be a part of the house. And then finally, you had the third category. And those were the hired men category. You might think in today's terminology, it might be the day laborer as you think about it. It's just somebody who has no real emotional attachment. It's just you came, you worked for a few hours, and you got paid something. They may not know your name. They may not know much about you or care to know much about you. You just came and you provided a service, and then you went on your way. That's the person. It's the hired man, the day laborer. That's what this boy now aspires to be in his father's household. He's under no delusion, right? He's under no delusion that he'll be able to return home and return to his former status as a child, as a son. He's given that up by his own poor choices. He's foregone all of that. He just wants to go home to be a hired day laborer in his father's service. And so he's motivated to come home. But I want you to notice who exactly it is that the boy decides to come back to. In verse 18, he says, I will get up and go back home. That's not what he says, is it? He says, I will get up and I'll go back to the farm. That's not what he says. I'll get up and go back to the family. That's not what he says. He says, I will get up and go back to my father. And the same thing in verse 20. I think the text emphasizes this point. He got up and he came to not the farm, not to his friends. He didn't come back home to mama. He didn't come back home to good biscuits and gravy. He came back home to his father. It's his father primarily he had violated or hurt, and it was to his father to whom he would return. I wonder if we think about that clearly as we think about our own lives. When we think about folks who have left the Lord, do we encourage people to come back to the church or to our church family? Or do we primarily encourage them to come back to the Lord? It's the Lord with whom, our Father, we need the relationship most desperately. Who is it that's most important? The boy is motivated to come back to his Father more than he is anything else that he had left previously. And so we come to the main part of the story that I want us to think about, And that is the father's love for this boy. It's one thing for the boy to determine to go home. It's something else for the boy to be received back home, right? Now, you think about God, and obviously the Father is a parallel for God in this account. We have a lot of things we know about God. You think about the majesty of God. When I think about God's majesty, I think back to passages like Isaiah chapter 6, and a fairly grand throne scene of God, where God is described as God on his throne, and his train, the train of his robe, fills the temple. You know, just a magnificent view of God and these, you know, seraphim that are there, these impressive angels. He's a majestic God. We have lots of pictures in the Old and New Testament about God being majestic. We see the power of God. We think about the power of God in creation. We've been studying about in Genesis. We see the power of God, for example, in Revelation chapter 4, when his voice sounds like the voice of thunder. We see as he's surrounded on his throne by the 24 elders who are constantly praising him. And we see and we know that God is a sacrificial God. Revelation chapter 5, the very next chapter, for example, it's all about the Lamb who was slain, the Lamb who was worthy of taking and breaking that seal. But here we see in verse 20 something about the heart of God, about the motivation of God, about what makes God care. Verse 20 says, when he was still a long way off, when this boy, this prodigal, was still a long way off, the father saw him, ran to him, embraced him, and kissed him. You know, there's a lot to that picture, I think. I don't know a whole lot. We aren't told, obviously, anything about the setting here. But I picture God as a father on a front porch. And again, we have no idea what this all looked like. But in my mind, I don't know if this was a Bible class teacher when I was a boy or if it was an illustration somebody drew up. But I picture kind of the house, the main house, being kind of a little on a hill. Not a steep hill, but just a nice hill. And there at the top, kind of a modest house with a front porch on it. And kind of sweeping views all the way down. You can see a long way from the house, way down to this valley. Maybe there's a small stream down there. And there's the one, you know, dirt path that leads all the way up to the house. And I picture that this is a father who is, you just can't wait for his son to come home. And so he's waiting for his son. I wonder if we're as willing to be patient with those who have wronged us, maybe even our own children, as what this father was with his. You know, sometimes we just don't want to speak about those who have left the faith. We might even say, well, just let them, you know, take their lumps, let them learn the hard way. You know, maybe we learned the hard way, so we'll let them learn the hard way. We're kind of tough or fairly unloving. Maybe we fail to even speak about them. You know, the father here, it seems, evidently understood this boy's state. It wasn't the father was ignorant about it. Verse 30 indicates that the older son knew that he was living with harlots. I suppose something the father knew as well. But in verse 32, the father calls him dead. My son who was dead has returned to me. I think the father understood. This boy was making poor choices. The father was no fool. He understood what it meant to ask for your inheritance early and to go live with it loosely. And yet the father still is longing for his son to return. Again, we're not told, but I can just imagine a father, and you might imagine his daily routine. I can just imagine a father who gets up in the morning and the first thing he does is to go to that kitchen window and look out the window. I can just imagine him straining, looking down that path to see, is this the day? Is my boy going to come back to his senses today? You might imagine he gets a cup of coffee as he's sitting there looking. And it wasn't no guesswork required on the part of anybody else in the house, right? The older boy and the wife and whoever these bondservants are, they understand what he's looking for. He's not just looking for the newspaper. He's not looking for the breakfast to be served or some package to be delivered. He's looking for his boy who's been lost who's chosen to go the other direction. And you might imagine he goes throughout his day, he works in the field or whatever it is he does, makes the decisions he has to. And I envision there's a porch on this front house. And again, this is my mind, so you may be a very different picture than yours. But I imagine there's a rocking chair out there. And at the eve, in the dusk of the day, he kind of finishes his day by doing the same thing he'd done at the beginning, looking down that road to see, is the boy coming today? Is there any sign that someone's coming today? I honestly think that most of us would give up. I don't know that we can handle that kind of disappointment. But God keeps looking. God keeps longing. In verse 20, when he first sees him, which is a long way off, I don't know how he recognized him being so far away, but I think it's a good indication he was looking pretty consistently, expectantly almost, for his son to come home. The first thing it says is that the father felt compassion. There's a lot of other words I might have imagined would have been used rather than compassion on that occasion. It might have been he felt some judgment. About time, hope he learned a lesson. He's coming on home. You might have imagined that he felt vindication. I told that boy if he did this, he'd be sorry. He'd be coming back. I can imagine myself thinking that, or maybe even saying it, as much as I hate to admit it. I can imagine that he might be felt anger. So you come back now, do you? What do you want? The next half of the inheritance? Just a spite almost. It's not what this father feels. The father's heart went out to this boy long before his hand ever reached him. The father's longing for him to return. Don't you want to come home to a God like this? This is the God that we serve. And so he sees the boy a long way off. He feels compassion. And the next thing we see in verse 20 is that he ran to the boy. Now, I don't know what you picture with that either. But he's a father. He's got two grown sons. I don't think he was a young man. It's not very dignified, I think, to see an old man running. And I don't suppose that this man didn't go inside and suit up for the run. He didn't go get his jogging suit on, or in my dad's case, jeans, and didn't go get his nice running shoes and lace them up and go down to jog down the road. This was a man who I suppose was wearing typical Hebrew garb, right? He has his robe on. It's kind of like a long dress we might picture. I don't know how you run in something like that in a dignified manner. I don't know if he held in one hand, the long flowing robes and kind of ran with the other, or if he just let his robes, fall behind him. I mean, I picture that as he's running here down this, dirt path, that the, dust is probably flowing behind him. It's getting him dirty. There's nothing dignified about this. An old man's not supposed to run. The old man's supposed to be the guy who sits and waits. Others come to him, right? It's kind of a sign of honor that they would come to him to seek his wisdom, seek his advice, seek his counsel, seek his answer. The father doesn't wait for his boy to come all the way up that path to get to the road. He decides he's going to run to the boy. You might imagine, and you've all seen it, I'm sure, you might imagine a reunion maybe at an airport. I've seen it especially on international flights when you get out, you get past the security and there's the regular people who were on the flight and they're waiting to pick somebody up. And you see maybe you're traveling with an older person and you hear a lot of cheers when you come out of the gate. You think, oh, didn't know it's such a celebrity, before you realize it's the old guy behind you. And maybe he hasn't seen his family in a long time. Or returned from military service, perhaps. And so we see that the father runs to his son. And then he embraces him and kisses him at verse 20. The Greek word apparently means that he kisses him repeatedly. There's a fellow named Michael Pearson who said, "We love those who know the worst of us and yet don't turn their face away." It wasn't the father in ignorance loving his son. It was a father who well knew what his son had done and yet did not turn his face away. Now, remember, all of this that happens in verse 20 is before this boy ever has a chance to speak a word, right? He's rehearsed his speech. He's ready to humble himself. But all of this the father does is before the boy ever even acknowledges what he has done wrong. The boy is taking just a few steps toward home, and the father comes the rest of the way. And in verse 21, the boy, it seems to me, begins to kind of give his rehearsed speech. It doesn't seem like he's even able to finish his speech. He doesn't even get to the part about wanting to be a hired man. He just admits that he's not worthy to be called his son anymore. And the boy, or the father, it seems like, just stops him and says, enough said. And he tells his servants, you know, go get the best robe. Go get a ring for his finger. Go get sandals for his feet. It's like the father won't even permit his son into his house. He's going to be the only one who's going to see his son in this disgraced state. I don't know what that boy looked like, but I can imagine this boy was malnourished. Surely he didn't have the, you know, proper clothing. He didn't have nice clothing on. And it's like the father isn't willing for his boy to be seen in his house looking like that. So he wants his servants to bring out to him the best of things to wear so that when he gets to the threshold of that door, he'll be restored as his son. This is the kind of father that you and I have. Apparently, and I'll say this in conclusion, but apparently in times of war, and then coming back from war in particular, and some of you might know this firsthand, there's a tradition of in the U.S., and apparently it's other places in the world as well, of tying yellow ribbons in various places. I think there's a song about a yellow ribbon in a woman's hair as kind of a sign of it's okay to return home. And we see yellow ribbons, I think, on cars even, and fence posts and front doors and other places. I think the tradition, as I understand it, goes back many, many years, maybe hundreds of years perhaps. I don't know where exactly it began. I'm not sure anybody really knows. And there was a song in 1973, I don't remember that, maybe some of you do, Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree, that was sung by Dawn and featured Tony Orlando. And I don't know if this next story is somehow connected to that or where exactly it came about. And as a matter of fact, I couldn't tell you where I even read this story or who wrote it. But I read it some number of years ago, and it made an impression on me, and so I wrote it down. There was an older gentleman named Dr. Rosenberry who was riding on a train in the 1920s on his way to a speaking engagement. He noticed a boy in his early 20s acting very nervous, moving from one seat to another. Dr. Rosenberry approached the young man and asked him if he could be of some help. So the young man told him his story. The young man said, 3 years ago, I had a fight with my dad, and I ran away from home. I wrote my mother a couple of months ago and told her I really wanted to come home, but didn't think I could, because I didn't think Dad would ever forget what I said to him that night. It was an awful thing to say to my father, to wish him dead. But I knew I was going to be crossing this part of Florida, and our home is right next to the train tracks. So I told my mom that if she would talk to Dad, and if it was okay for me to come home, I'd be going by on the train. And if they would just tie a handkerchief, just one white handkerchief on the fence post out by the corner of our lot, I'd see it when I went by. And I'd get off at the next depot just down the way, and I'd come home. The young man said, sir, we're getting close to our property, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do if that handkerchief is not there. He said, would you do me a favor, mister? When we come around that bend, would you look out there for me? Because I can't look. And tell me if there's a handkerchief on the post. When they came around the bend, everyone on the train started clapping and hollering. Because they'd taken every sheet in the house, every blanket that was white. They'd strung them from the trees, from the fence posts, from the front of the house. The conductor stopped the train. And Dr. Rosenberry says the last thing he saw was that young man silhouetted against the white sheets flapping in the wind, running up the road to go home. I don't know where that story came from, but it has its roots in Luke 15. There are some sheets, there are some white sheets flapping on the hills of eternity for you. God wants us to come home. While he's still a long way off, the Father saw him, ran to him, embraced him, and kissed him. I tell you, in the same way, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Verse 7. Don't you think it's time to come home to your Father? If you're subject to the invitation, will you make that known as we stand and sing?